evening and welcome to Bird Calls from the Knoll Foundation Studios here at Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. And we invite you to call in with your questions tonight about our feathered friends and the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he's ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he's had since 1997, and he has been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M University Press, and he has authored more than 80 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife Julie and their two children live in East Texas. And Cliff, welcome back for another show. It's just been a short time since we rearranged our September schedule a little bit.
It has, but the coolest thing is the cool weather.
Right.
So I'm happy to come down when in the last, 36 hours, we've had that continental cold snap that's made it very pleasant outside. So
I personally, I approve of pleasant myself.
Yes.
I wonder if the birds do. Do they approve of pleasant?
It definitely pushes birds down. So we're going to start seeing some changes thanks to the weather.
Oh, so maybe a little migration. A
little bit. Some people be unhappy that that kind of weather pushes the hummingbirds out of here, but it also brings in other species. So it's a changing of the guard. You have to appreciate that.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Right now, any question regarding birds and birding is our welcome right now. And Cliff, we ended last month with another conservation tip, and what do you have for us as a recap this week?
Yeah, we talked about a topic that gets a lot of discussion in the media and even around the coffee table, and it's climate change. We talked about the great Kiskadee and how it's moving north. There are a lot of other birds that are moving north: least grebe, clay-colored thrush, ring kingfisher, white-tipped dove, and there's birds that used to be in North Texas where I grew up that you could find in the winter that are really hard to find now. They don't need to come as far south as northern Louisiana and northern Texas anymore. Things like American tree sparrow, rough-legged hawk, and evening grosbeak. So even if you don't want to acknowledge climate change, that's fine. That's your prerogative. But what we tried to talk about is that certainly we can make improvements that will make our planet a better place to live, a healthier place and a happier place. You know, working on things like standardizing efficiency standards for vehicles, limiting pollution, minimizing the clearing of habitat, native habitats. There's so much we can do in the name of saving money, in the name of making it a better place for us to live in. We've talked about how green space around us is good for the soul as well. So that's what we talked about last month, and I know it's a contentious issue, but certainly the common ground is we can make life better.
Every month we go in and do a profile of a species. Let me give the numbers out real quick, and then we'll get into our weekly or our monthly profile. The numbers to call right now, 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And what's our profile species this month?
And it's our 50th episode tonight.
50.
Do we have to have a cake for that?
I don't know. Maybe a walker.
Well, tonight we're going to profile the dark-eyed junco, and it's a species that's very widespread and a common resident, winter resident, that does not breed in the Red River Radio listening area. So we don't ever hear the full territorial breeding song, but instead we hear their loud, high-pitched chip notes as played here. All that smacking is the junco.
not the most song-like of songs.
No. And you can hear a brown thrasher in the background making right. that kind of that meowing sound. But, yeah, it's not very musical. That chip note kind of resembles a fast kissing sound, like a quick peck on the cheek. This bird will visit your seed feeder full of mixed seeds in fall and winter. The best field mark for most dark-eyed juncos is an overall gray and white bird with a pale-colored bill and, when flushed, flashes white in the outer tail feathers. In winter, they often flock with other sparrows, cardinals, and other species of birds. Juncos like to hang out in thickets, woodland edges, weedy fields, and brushy fence rows. This is a widespread North American species occurring from Canada south through the U.S. and extending into northern Mexico. This species has a total U.S. and Canadian population estimate of 190 million individual birds, making it our nation's fourth most abundant species. How about that? There are six regional populations or races, and each look slightly different from the next, plus each goes by a different name. Here in the southeastern U.S., the predominant race is what's known as the slate-colored. That makes quite a mouthful when you're telling someone that you saw the slate-colored race of the dark-eyed junco. This species will be trickling into our listening area starting right now, especially with the help of the recent much-needed cool front. And their fall migration will extend for several more weeks after now. Most individuals should get settled in by mid-November into wherever they seek to overwinter. The junco's most commonly used colloquial name in the South is snowbird, suggesting that it's around here during our colder months. In spring, most depart our area by mid-March, but a few stragglers will linger with us until mid-April. Smart birds leave us in spring long before our hot summers. Most are headed to the cool boreal forest to breed. To see a photo of a dark-eyed junco snap by James Childress, please visit the Bird Calls page at redriverradio.org.
And you can also listen to that call again, so you can kind of memorize it. And while you hear them, you might go out and flash some photos of these birds. In Florida, snowbirds were something quite
That's
different.
Right.
Yeah, they were retirees.
Yep, in Texas, too. In South Texas and on the coast, those are, yeah, you see them. They've got Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota license plates for Texas. And then probably when you're in Florida, there were a lot of New York and other northeastern
states. A lot
of
Midwestern, too, Ohio, and Canada, ironically.
Oh, yeah, cool.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have our first caller online from Henderson, Texas. This is Don. Don, you're on with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
My question is about hummingbird nectar, but before that, I want to make a comment about the juncos. I was just in Seattle for the summer and saw the juncos there. I think it's the Oregon junco or the dark-eyed junco. Nice to know. I get to see them one more time, or twice a season.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll be coming up soon.
Yep. Those were probably Oregon juncos, and they're probably the most colorful of the bunch. They're really a beautiful bird. A lot of contrast. The head's so much darker than any of the other juncos.
Yeah, they really do stand out.
Yeah.
A lot of the small birds are hard to distinguish, but that dark head really does make a difference. Cool. Good to hear that.
Yeah.
Okay, my question is about hummingbird nectar. I was preparing one a few months ago, so I went online to find the recipe. I just wondered what your favorite recipe is for feeding hummingbirds.
Okay, well, that's a great one, and we still have hummingbirds hanging around the listening area, and what we also recommend is keep feeders up in the South year-round. It's an old wives' tale that says you have to bring it in or the birds won't migrate. Well, that's baloney. Those birds are going to migrate when they want, and we also get Rocky Mountain birds that winter with us, things like rufous hummingbird. And what they like to drink, that to answer your question, Don, is 4 parts water to 1 part sugar. Let me say that again. 4 parts water to 1 part sugar. Never, ever red dye. Never. The red should be in the feeder, in the plastic of the feeder. Or you can hang red ribbon, red bandana nearby. The red is the flash of color, like a neon sign that says, hey, here's food, just like what a flower advertises when it gives nectar. So, again, 4 parts water, 1 part sugar, and you can brew that just like making tea at the house. You want to cool it. And you can make a big batch of it and keep it cool in the fridge, and that way every few days you can replace what's in the feeder. And what I recommend is after, if it's hot, after about 3 or 4 days, dump what you've got in there, even if they didn't drink it, because it spoils, just like milk, and dump it out and replace it with the batch that you have in your refrigerator. So you're always staying ahead of the game. So if you know it's going to be September, that's when we get, in our listening area, the most hummingbirds, and they're 99% ruby-throated, but we get a lot of individuals, and then you know to put out maybe an extra feeder and brew a little bit extra more in the pitcher in your fridge because you know you're going to be keeping very busy. So, Don, are you seeing a lot of hummingbirds in Henderson?
Well, I've just been back for about half a week. And somebody took down the feeder, so I've got to put it back up and get it started again. But I didn't know you need to replace it every 3 or 4 days.
That's
kind of amusing to me.
That's in the hot summer. And so since we recommend keeping it up year-round, if it's a cool winter day, even if you don't have hummingbirds, you can probably let it go for about a week. Because it's cool outside, it doesn't spoil. And you can tell. You look at a feeder that's been sitting there a long time, 2 weeks in the summer, and it just looks really thick, and it looks like there's something in there that's real viscous, and it's spoiled. So what a lot of people do is they fill the feeder up, and they say, I'm not going to replace it until those birds clear their plate. Well, that works with a four-year-old at the dinner table, but it doesn't work with hummingbirds. So if that's the case, if it's June and July and there's not a lot of hummingbird activity, just a few, don't fill the feeder up if you know you're going to have to replace it after 3 or 4 days. But once September comes, if it's like my yard, we are overrun, especially before this cool front. So probably Sunday-ish, we had a big departure because there was lots of hummingbirds. I could see 7 or 8 at a time, and then there was down to 0 and maybe 1. So I would keep the feeders really full in September just because there's a lot more individuals. Those are birds that bred to our north that are passing through, that are refueling just like they would at a gas station on a long journey. Like if it was you and I driving, we'd not only fill up our gas tank, we'd fill up our belly on a long journey, and that's what these birds are doing. These are birds that bred to our north in the Great Lakes, and could be Missouri and Iowa. All those birds are pouring through this listening area as they're headed to the tropics to winter in places like Mexico through Costa Rica. And that's the ruby-throated that I'm specifically talking about. So, all right, Don. Well, I hope you get to enjoy some hummingbirds soon. And remember, 4 parts water, 1 part sugar, and that's white table sugar, no other sweetener. Not the yellow packs, not the pink packs, not Splenda, nothing. Just stick to white table sugar. It's readily available. Everybody knows what it is. It's in your house. Use it. And don't switch sweeteners.
So not even honey, huh?
No, I wouldn't even switch to honey. It's not worth it. It's just a lot easier just to stick with sugar. And then I've heard some people change the ratio. We don't recommend that, and just stick to the 4-to-1, and it's just stick with the rules and don't try to be fancy.
All right. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We go next to our caller from Coushatta, Rob. And by the way, Kathy from Longview, please stay on the line. You're up next. And Rob from Coushatta, you are up next. What's your question for Cliff?
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have two questions. One, is it my imagination, or has the loggerhead shrike pretty much disappeared from north west Louisiana?
Okay.
That's my first question.
Okay. And go ahead with second one.
And my second question is, what kind of bird, well, I was out there walking on the edge of a woodland pasture, dense hardwood bottom on one side, big open pasture on the other, about twilight. It was getting pretty dark. I was going to head into the edge of the woods for a moment, and some kind of bird said, "Hey," and it seems like somebody, and kind of almost gave me a heart attack.
Huh.
What kind of bird was called out with a "hey" call?
Yeah. What, was it dark yet?
Or it was just about dark. You couldn't hardly see.
Okay. Sometimes the barred owl will yell and make a scream that will, you know, make the hair on the back of your neck stick up. And I've heard them do that on occasion, and it might be what you heard, because there's nothing. Is it something you've ever heard before? Are you out in the woods a lot?
Never before or since.
Yeah, and so that's
like something says, "Hey!"
If you'd said, you know, "I've heard it for 30 years, I don't know what it is," then it's something you hear a lot. But because you're not hearing it often, I'm betting it's the barred owl, the big loud scream they do. And we don't have a recording of that. We have the normal recordings of the normal barred owl, which we're not going to play. But this is a just one loud scream that I think I've mentioned on this show before, that if you were setting up your tent, you were going to camp, and you heard that above your tent, you'd probably pack up and go home.
That's pretty much what I thought.
Yeah. So
I've heard the owls in the woods. I don't know which one makes a deep hoo 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 hoo.
Yeah.
Noise. I've heard them all the time.
Yeah. This is just one of their different vocalizations that they do, and it's not very common when they do it. So I bet you it's the barred owl. And it's very atypical that they do it, but they can do it, and it does freak people out when they hear it. So let's go over to the loggerhead shrike, and yes, they have certainly disappeared. They have the continental decline is closing in on 70% in the loggerhead shrike, and another one that's going with it, and because they share the same habitat, are the eastern meadowlark and the northern bobwhite.
Yep.
And
I have heard.
Yep.
None of them. I haven't seen a shrike in probably 20 years, and I haven't heard a meadowlark since I was little, and nor haven't heard a bobwhite in probably 20 years.
Yeah, those three birds are on the same trajectory, and they need pretty much the same thing. You can see exceptions, like the shrike is one that will do well in urban areas. The other two do not. So you'll see shrikes hanging out in business parks, city parks, places where there's mowed grass with scattered trees. They like that kind of a setting, but you'll never see a bobwhite in the city limits or an eastern meadowlark. It would be a rare thing. I mean, there's exceptions, don't get me wrong.
Last time I saw a shrike, you ain't gonna believe this, is on the Red River floodplain just south of Shreveport.
Wow.
And on a fence.
And how long ago did you say that was?
About 20 years ago.
Gosh.
Last time I saw one.
Yeah, they're declining. They're not gone completely, but again, a 70% decline means you're missing 7 out of 10 individuals, and there's still 3-ish out there. But that makes it really hard to find. So those three, go ahead.
And you know, another bird I've seen increase dramatically is the scissor-tailed flycatcher.
Yeah, and that's another bird that can tolerate city limits. You'll see a lot of scissor-tails doing well with parking lots and high wires.
They live in, I work in Natchitoches. They live all in the areas around Sibley Lake and come light away. I mean, right in the middle of the working parking lot, they'll light and run around the ground.
Yeah.
And lie on the fences there. They live on that mow. There's a big, huge levee, and they just hunt there constantly. I sit there and watch it. There'll be 5 or 6, 7 lined up on a power line.
Yeah, and what's really neat right now, this time of the year, is they get in these big communal roosts. And I found one on Sunday evening, right at dusk. It was 7:04. I remember it because I looked at my clock. I had a cloud of about 200 scissor tails fly over me in Caldwell, Texas. I was driving to a meeting first thing in the morning at our headquarters in Austin. So Caldwell is between College Station and Austin in east central Texas. And that's, I think, my fourth city I've found these big roosts where there are hundreds of scissor tails that get together and sleep in numbers. And then go out in the day and do their thing. But scissor tails are going to be pushed out of here pretty soon. They leave this month. They're hard to find. in the first few days of November, there might be a straggler, but then they get really tough to find after that. But let's go back to the shrike, meadowlark, and bobwhite. I've mentioned this before. The reason those are in decline, you might think, you know, people want to blame it on fire ants and all these other things, but it's native habitat and it's native grassland habitat. So we drive around, we see grassland habitat, and we think, oh, well, what's the problem? It's not the right habitat. It's not the right grass. It's usually non-native grass what we're seeing, things like coastal Bermuda and then tons of other, KR bluestem, Johnson grass. I mean, they're fescue. I could go on and on.
Bahia,
exactly. Those are all not native, and they all, most of them create a carpet grass that these birds, especially the quail, don't like to sit up on and be obvious. They want to be hiding in the native bunch grasses. And then those native bunch grasses host a lot of insects that the shrike is after. And so these monocultures of coastal Bermuda don't have much biological diversity. There's not much living in there. There's not much to eat. And so it's a biological desert. And that's why we don't see a lot of these birds in a coastal Bermuda field. So the bottom line
is, when I was little, like, you'd see them. There was lots of them around. My grandpa had a barbed wire fence around the property, and kind of like a semi-mowed, maybe mowed once a year, bushhog once a year field. Had all kind of stuff in it, like all different kinds of grasses and all like little shrubs and all kind of fall flowers that are blooming right now.
Oh, wow.
It was a pretty field.
Yeah,
and
that sounds native.
Shrikes, they would catch big grasshoppers, little grasshoppers, crickets, and lizards and small snakes and stick them on the barbed wire.
Yeah, that's the cool thing about the shrike. They're called the butcher bird. You can tell what they're catching because they like to impale food items on barbed wire. And before barbed wire, they used thorny limbs like honey locust and anything else that had a spiny limb that they could impale food items on. And so the decline is because of habitat.
Another thing I noticed disturbing real quick, I didn't see a lot of mockingbirds this year. Normally, my yard is full of mockingbirds. I didn't see a one.
Yeah, that's alarming, and I don't know the answer to that. So mockingbirds.
I still have my brown thrashers, but normally they'll nest and they'll fuss at you.
Yeah,
I didn't even see a one nest this year. I think I seen two the whole year. I live so far out in the country, and I don't even think I've seen any in the city lately.
Wow, yeah, that's alarming. I don't have an answer or response for that. So
they don't migrate, do they, out of here?
Well, they do. They move in short distances, but nothing like what we're used to with ruby-throated hummingbirds or broad-winged hawks. Not any big movements, but there are short-range movements in mockingbirds. The banding show that. So it could
and
be.
I'll keep
yeah.
an eye out on them.
Yeah, keep
and
an
I'll
eye out, Rob.
I'll go back what I see.
Yeah.
I'll call y'all in the spring.
Great.
Because they normally sing all night long. The male get up
right.
to get up on the antenna and sing all night
That's
long.
Right. That's right. Well, Rob, you seem real tuned in to wildlife around you, so congratulations for that. Thank you for being watching for our wildlife. Appreciate that.
All right, and you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have almost all lines open right now, so you'll get in pretty quickly. We do have one more caller online, Kathy from Longview. You are on with Cliff. What's your question?
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question's about wild turkeys. I visited the Fredericksburg area a few years back and drove the Willow City Loop, and I saw turkeys traveling along the road. They weren't behind fences and could go anywhere that they wanted to go.
Yeah.
And I've lived in East Texas and traveled East Texas for over 50 years, but I've never seen any wild turkeys.
Yeah.
I was wanting to know why the wild turkeys have had a difficult time populating in East Texas.
Yeah, that's a great question, and fairly similar to our discussion in the last call with the decline in shrike and bobwhite. Wild turkeys, yeah, you'll go to other parts of the state in Texas and see gobs of them. South Texas, the hill country like you mentioned in Fredericksburg,
right.
The rolling plains up near Wichita Falls, I mean, in all points in between, they're doing really well, but the what we call the eastern wild turkey that lives in the woods, we've not been treating the woods correctly, and that's why they have gone. Now, what we also have to back up to a time where hunting wasn't regulated. Everybody was hungry, and they, you know, in East Texas, you can look back, and there were white-tailed deer were a problem in that they were a decline because of unregulated hunting. People were hungry. Like in the Depression, they kept shooting everything. And so I think what we had to begin with is a combination of a lot of the game were removed because people were hungry. And then we haven't done well with managing our forests. When we've taken out the historical forests and replaced them, we haven't made it such that wild turkey do well. So wild turkey need these open pine stands in the spring and summer. They need to move to the bottomlands in the winter to eat acorns. They've got to deal with pigs, wild hogs that are also getting in there and eating all those acorns in the winter. The uplands that I mentioned, we're not burning our forests. We don't have the native grasses. A lot of those native grasses would have the grasshoppers that Rob mentioned in the previous call that the wild turkey poults, the young guys, would eat. And so instead we overstock our pine stands, and they're so dense, so thick that no grass can grow under them. And just drive around anywhere in this whole ecoregion, whether you're in the Texas side, or Louisiana side, Oklahoma, Arkansas side, doesn't matter. There's been a big cultural shift in silviculture and how we manage our woods, and it's not working out for the wild turkey because there have been lots of efforts, especially with my agency, of restocking. And we do what's called a super stock. We find areas that fit the description of what turkeys need. The landowner has agreed to continue making it right for turkey, and we get some turkeys from another state like Iowa, and we'll bring them down and release them, and it doesn't work every time. So it doesn't work because we, as a whole, we haven't gotten the woods right like it was historically for wild turkey. And I'm afraid that it's, unless we have a cultural shift in how we manage our forests, we're never going to get them back, no matter how hard we try by bringing birds from other states. It should speak volumes if we do that and it doesn't work. It should say we still aren't doing something right. And what we need with wild turkey are giant landscapes. So you can't just have 500 acres and expect turkeys to work. They need tens of thousands of acres and lots of turkey individuals for turkeys to work. Because guess what? Everybody likes the flavor of turkey. Every predator out there loves to eat turkey. So when you have a species like that, you're going to have to pump out a lot of individuals, and we're just not doing it. But if you want to see turkeys, you went to a place where turkeys are doing great in the Hill Country. And I, you know, it's a different animal over there. We've learned not to introduce those western birds over here. They can't handle the high rains, the heavy rains. It's just a moister environment. So we have to get those eastern birds from other eastern parts of the country. So, because I look at it and go, God, look, there's got to be a surplus here in Fredericksburg. Let's borrow some of these birds. But, yeah, they don't like it. They like that drier, hotter climate with the stunted mesquites and cedar, and they just don't like the 100-foot-tall pines over here.
I see. I've learned a lot, and I really do enjoy your show.
Oh, great. Thank you, Kathy.
Thank you very much.
All right. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we have one line open and four lines full, so we're going to get right to the next question. Mary from Jefferson, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Cliff, as a professional, I would like to know your professional opinion on photographing nesting birds. Because there's lots of Facebook pages, and they don't allow them. But then they're showing up on pages of, photographs of Texas.
Right.
And I tell them politely that they're not supposed to be photographing nesting birds, and I get all kinds of slack.
Well, we've covered that one, especially in regards to rookeries down the coast, where there's a little jingle that says you need to be 50 yards away, and so that's the rule for a lot of these bigger birds like herons and pelicans on the coast, because what happens is photographers get too close and that flushes the adults, and then the sun starts to cook the eggs, because believe it or not, the adults are shading the eggs so they don't overcook. And also what happens on the coast is you get predatory birds like laughing gulls can move in and steal the eggs and eat them.
Right.
And in the rest of the world, it's the same thing. You just don't want to flush mom or dad off the eggs. It makes them vulnerable. Some birds will completely abandon a nest, especially early on in the nesting season. A pair will just abandon the nest. Luckily, there's a stronger bond with nestlings, especially the older nestlings. The parents will come back. But remember, we all grew up, mom and dad said, you know, don't touch baby birds. Mom will smell you. They don't really smell you, but the message was good. The facts were not correct, but the message was good. And we still need to do that. And like you're mentioning with photographers, so we need to keep our distance and not disrupt birds, because they're in their bat cave and they don't want the bat cave location to be found for a lot of birds, woodland birds, for instance. So once they have been found, they don't like it. So keep the distance, and I applaud these magazines that won't run nestling birds, baby birds, that kind of stuff, because yeah, that means the photographer probably got a little too close and that can jeopardize the nest. And so yeah, keep your distance. That's a great message, Mary, and I'm glad you called. So that's my opinion, is people should keep their distance.
Yeah, these were eastern bluebirds, and there were four babies, and mama was sitting on them, and I was not happy, and I took a lot of slack for it. But
yeah, and so bluebird babies, that means you had to go up to the box and it's hinged, and you open the box. And yeah, and I know a lot of people like to do that, but if you camp out with a camera and wait for the lighting to be right or the bird to move, the young bird, it's disruptive, and I just don't, it's not a good idea.
I didn't think so.
Yeah, so, well, thank you for the call, Mary.
Thank you for your opinion.
Yep.
Bye.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502 or go online with us and check out the Bird Call page. And we are going next to our next caller, Steve from Bernice. And what is your question tonight, Steve?
Well, occasionally we have scarlet tanagers pass through.
Uh-huh.
I recently read that they like sugar water, but they can't get it out of a hummingbird feeder. What kind of a feeder would you put out?
Well, there are oriole feeders that are like a hummingbird feeder specifically for these larger birds. So if you go out west, you'll see things like ladderback woodpeckers and various orioles. They'll also hang on a hummingbird feeder, and people don't like it. I wouldn't either, because when they tilt the feeder, all that nectar spills out on the ground. Then you got an ant problem and an empty feeder. So to accommodate the tanager, you can put out an oriole nectar feeder. So look online for that. And that's not to be confused with the jelly oriole feeder. That's a different kind of feeder that people will put out for rose-breasted grosbeaks, Baltimore orioles, and other birds. But no, I, you know, most of the time tanagers are not big time problems with hummingbird feeders, but that would be a good solution, Steve, is to look up that kind of feeder that would not spill with the weight of a big bird on it like a hummingbird feeder does.
Does it hang like a hummingbird
feeder? Yeah, it does.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
And I don't own one, so I've seen them before, but I guess I'm not picturing in my head how they mount differently. I just know they don't tip over and tilt with the weight of a heavy bird.
Well, I was wondering if you could use a thing to water chickens with or something.
Yeah, you could if you could make sure. I think your wasp would be a problem. You know, wasps and bees would just go crazy for a big port like that to feed, because that's another one that people don't want to mess with, and the birds won't often come in. If there's 75 bees and wasps, the tanager's going to say, hey, I'm moving on.
That's the fiercest bird I've ever seen, though. The first time I ever saw one, he flew down and caught a red wasp out of the air and landed on the clothesline.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Yeah, the summer tanager is a relative of the scarlet tanager, and they're real big bee eaters. And you'll see them camping out at beehives and doing just like what you said. They are tough. And also the eastern kingbird will do that too, and that's where he gets the colloquial name Bee Martin, eastern kingbird.
Same recipe as for the hummingbirds and
do
that every 3 or 4 days.
Yeah, that's right. Just do the same thing. It's just this one's designed a little differently so it won't tilt and spill.
And year-round, they're only going to pass through certain times anyway.
Chances are you're not going to host a wintering tanager. That's pretty unusual. It's happened, but it's super unusual. You know, people win the lottery. It happens, but not everybody wins the lottery. So, yeah, I sure wish I could, huh?
But they're fairly rare. But like I say, they're beautiful birds, and anything we can do to help them, I think would be a good thing.
Yeah, that's a good idea. All right, Steve. Well, thanks for the call.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Anything regarding our avian world and birding are available right now and are open for you to discuss. We go next to Leon from Bossier City. Leon, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Hey, what a wonderful show. Thank you, guys.
Hey, Leon.
Yeah, I have had a group of red-tailed hawks nesting in my area for the last 4 or 5 years.
Uh-huh.
And I think I saw one of them today, and he was being chased by another bird that was almost the same size, a little bit smaller, but it had a whole lot of white. I had some trees between me and a hawk, and I couldn't tell whether it was on his belly or it was on his tail.
Hmm.
What kind of critter would chase a red-tailed hawk?
Well, maybe another hawk, maybe a red-shouldered or maybe red-shouldered or broadwing. Broadwing's a lot smaller, but they're real pale underneath, and broadwings are pushing through our area right now in big numbers, and plus they spend the summer months breeding here. So, yeah, I'm guessing it's probably a different kind of hawk. And then also, not every two red-tailed hawks look the same. It could be a different-looking red-tailed hawk. There are a lot of there's a big variation in how red-tails look. So it could,
really?
It could be just a different-looking. I want to say there's 16 or 17 described color variations of the red-tailed hawk, what we'd call a race, and so you may have just seen a paler red-tailed hawk, and they're probably, you know, fighting over the same hunting grounds or the same squirrel or something. But yeah, it was probably another hawk.
I see.
Yeah.
Oh, great. Thank you for your help.
Yep. Thank you, Leon.
So good.
Great. Thank you.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502, or you can go online right now at redriverradio.org. And we've got Cheryl coming up next. Cheryl from El Dorado, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Hi, guys. I'm so glad to hear you on the air tonight, Cliff, because I had this wonderful bird experience this morning.
Okay.
My office is in my home. We live on a wooded lot. I've got a huge magnolia tree right outside my office, a north window, a yew tree, ligustrum, cedar, you name it. And there was this cacophony of birds that I couldn't tell what they were, sound and flying across. You know how beautiful the light was this morning.
Mm-hmm.
Flying, I could see shadows, and I walked outside. They were so loud. It was a blue jay. The blue jays have been going crazy. But they reminded me just the shadows and the noises they were making, although not exactly the same sound, as cedar waxwings. When the waxwings come after the yaupon berries in the spring. Well, of course, there are no yaupon berries. These were mockingbirds. It was a small flock of mockingbirds. Now, we've lived here for 25 years, and we know what we know and watch, our, not watch, but we have lots of birds. But there were, I counted at least seven.
Wow.
And they were chasing each other from tree to tree, and there were two at one time circling over the house. And what I don't recall that happening this time of year.
Yeah, that, you know, the previous caller tonight asked about, is there movement in mockingbirds? And I think you probably witnessed some staging of birds that were moving through your area. And so that's probably the, what you saw is a mixture of your resident birds pair trying to keep out all these other birds that are moving through, and everybody's trying to feed themselves, and it's just a mess. And that's probably where all the cacophony was, birds, you know, griping at each other and hollering at each other. But yeah, I think you probably witnessed a little bit of short-range movement or staging before movement of mockingbirds.
Well, it was just delightful. And I missed a portion, early portion of the show and parts of it. Did you say that the junco is also called a snowbird?
Yes.
Okay, all right.
Yeah,
Thank you very much.
It's a colloquial name that's used in the South to suggest that it's a bird from the north that comes down where it's warm and winters, and we've also given that same colloquial name Bill mentioned to humans.
Retirees
that don't want to shovel snow anymore up in the north.
Can you blame them?
I agree, yeah. Come on down where you can wear flip-flops and shorts, but they're smart. They go back up there because they know what July and August can be down here, so they go back up to where it's very pleasant up to our north. So
this is the land of flip-flops and white socks during the winter. That's winter clothing.
Yeah.
Well, the mockingbirds were delightful, and I hope others get to hear them. And Cliff, I'm on the advisory board, too.
Okay.
In fact, we'll be on the air in the morning.
Great.
Doing my on-the-air fundraising bit, and I'll mention your show. You're so popular.
Oh, great. Well, we appreciate that, Cheryl, and thanks for doing all you do on the advisory board. Thank you very much.
Take care.
Thank you. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we have all lines open right now at 800-552-8502 or online right now with us. You can follow along because we're going to go to some photographs right now. That since we have a lull here, we had some photographs that were sent to me by Michaela Lynn Briggs from over near Uncertain. A lot of these were taken around Caddo Lake, and we've got an interesting collection of some colorful and caricature birds. Let's go to the big white one between the trees there. Those are cypress trees, I believe. And what do we got there?
Yeah, and she's from Uncertain, but I'm very certain what the identity of these birds are. So Bill handed me these about 5 minutes before the show. And this one is a wood stork. And this is a bird that people see in wetland settings during our warmer months. And, you know, you can see one almost any month of the year, but the big numbers occur in starting in April, May, and then extend into October. We probably have the least amount of sightings between October and April. But wood storks will come in big numbers. They're a big white bird with a naked gray head and a black bill that's got a little bit of droop on it, but they're larger than any of our other wading birds that we have here. So if he stands next to a great egret or a great blue heron, the wood stork is a lot bigger, chunkier, taller, etc. What's the next bird you want to look at?
Well, that is a very colorful little bird, lots of blues and oranges and yellows on it, and it's, I'm not sure what it's pinned up against, but it's quite colorful, and it's a really pretty bird.
He's on a thistle feeder, and this is the American goldfinch, and the best feature is the black and white wings. Of course, this one's getting that goldy color, which you'll see on a few individuals throughout the winter, but mostly they lose that bright yellow when they're down here with us. But they'll molt into that bright yellow late in the season, so you can see some that look like this in April or May if they linger. But that's an American goldfinch at a feeder.
And you can go online right now and see these photographs on our wood or on our on our wood song page, on our bird calls page. I'm trying to do too many things at once right now. And the next one, I got to tell you, this is a goofy looking bird in that pose. That is like right out of a comic image. It's got this kind of a dullard look on its face, and it seems to be wobbling. But I'm sure that's just a moment in time.
And we looked at a wood stork earlier. This is the wood duck. And this is a female wood duck, and they feel right at home walking around on tree limbs like this one is doing. You can see rough bark. Looks like a pretty good-sized limb, and they nest in cavities in trees, or, you know, people put up nest boxes for them that are appropriately sized for wood duck. But this is the female wood duck. And, yeah, if you turn the picture thinking that the orientation's off, you can tell that it'd be off if you turned it 90 degrees.
Yeah.
Because the tree looks the same, but there's no way a wood duck can cling to a tree that you've turned vertically like that. So that limb is definitely horizontal, and it's a wood duck.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have lines open right now. We're waiting for our next caller to come in. So we are in the middle of our migratory season now. You said the hummingbirds had already kind of passed through. Are they still lingering around?
Yeah, there'll still be some ruby-throated hummingbirds lingering throughout the month. Once we get to November, they really drop off. Same goes with broad-winged hawks. That's another one that's really pouring through. That one you have to look way up. They're usually little tiny pepperflecks up high migrating in big numbers. And their peak passage was probably about 10 to 12 days ago, like September 20-something is when the peak passage is. But they're still lingers, and they'll be in front of this recent front and behind it, trying to get out of the center part of the U.S. where they breed, headed down to South America, which is pretty remarkable. So there are lots of other birds. We're going to start seeing waterfowl showing up. Sparrows of various species, those might be the two top groups as far as diversity goes, waterfowl and sparrows, that really push in big numbers into our area and winter with us. But there's all kinds of other critters that fly through in fall migration. Lots of shorebirds, lots of warblers will go through this area, but not many of the shorebirds and warblers will winter with us. The majority of them are just passing through.
And for folks who are getting ready for the Christmas bird count, do you have any information to talk about on that?
I have to compile. We do that every year. We figure out the nearest Christmas bird counts in our listening area, and there's about 10 or 12, and I've already heard from one or two compilers, so I need to I already wrote a note to myself earlier today to email the rest of the compilers to get the dates of the Christmas counts, and we can talk about that next month, and certainly in the December episode as well, because the Christmas count period doesn't start until December 14th, so we have some time before those occur. But those are a really good way to contribute data via citizen science, and a really good way to get out with people that know a lot and you can learn a lot, or if you already know a lot, you can share that with others that don't know a lot. There's just a lot of positive things with the Christmas bird count that I'm really a big fan of it, and it's a lot of fun.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. And Lorraine from Wind Parish, we lost you somewhere, so please call back right now because we lost you in the transfer there. But anybody else, all of our lines are open right now. You'll get right in at 800-552-8502. 855-252-8502. So let's say somebody wants to go out and really witness some of this migration of birds that are coming through. What are the best areas? You know, would it be aquatic areas, woodland areas, depending on the kind of bird, I presume, that you want to spot? But where would you really get a feast for the eyes for migratory birds?
For the hawks that I mentioned, any little hill in your community where you have a commanding view and there's not a lot of trees in the way, because you're looking to the north, so you don't want to be in a forest, obviously. You want to have a kind of a clearing up on a hill where you can see things coming in, and just, you know, pretend you're looking for airplanes that are way up, but you're going to look up high with binoculars for little tiny pepperflecks that are birds. And there are several species, but broad-winged is the dominant, but you can see both Coopers and sharp-shinned hawks up in the groups. You can see bald eagles, kestrels, merlins, peregrine falcons. There's a lot of these different raptors that are pushing through at the same time and using kind of the same method of climbing up, getting altitude with a thermal, and then streaming across and going south. And so when they lose altitude further down the way, then they have to hit another thermal and get back up. But the name of the game is saving energy, and so that means no or minimal to no flapping. So that's why they're using thermals, and that's why when they get up high, they stream over. They're not flapping, and they're not expending any calories. They're not using up juice. And that makes migration really easy, because some of these birds are going to travel several thousand miles. So it makes it a lot easier to ride those thermals and not have to flap your way south.
And they end up looking like glider planes going through the air.
Yeah, sense, there you go.
All right, we've got two calls online. Lewis, I'm not sure where you're from. Please state where you're from, and you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Hello, this is Lewis, and I'm from Zawali, but I am calling from, I now live in Stonewall, Louisiana.
Okay.
And I was listening earlier, and you mentioned the wood duck. And I think I learned something interesting recently. Saw some wood ducks. They were circling a tree. This is around turkey hunting season.
Mm-hmm.
And I told my father what had happened. And he said that wood ducks will lay their eggs in another bird's nest.
Mm-hmm.
And that would make them somewhat like a cowbird. And I wanted to see if that was true or not.
Yeah, it is true. And that's true for a lot of ducks. And the thought, especially with wood ducks, it could be that it's a shortage of cavities and that there are all these females that are ready to lay and there's not enough cavities to do it. So if they find somebody else's nest, they will dump their eggs. And you'll see that often. You can see baby wood ducks that there might be 25 or 30, and there's no way that one female laid all those eggs. You'll see that with redhead ducks. Several other species of ducks will do the same thing. It's called egg dumping, and ducks do it very commonly, and the wood duck's no exception. So, yep, your dad was correct when he told you that, Lewis.
All right, and we've got to get to our next caller here, George from Bossier City. George, you're on with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Well, I don't know if you really want to talk to me. I didn't know the rule about staying the distance from birds. I had a pair of robins put a nest on the windowsill in front of my house. And I put my tripod out there with my long lens on it.
Yeah.
And I got some great pictures, but it wasn't 50 feet.
Yeah. No, it was 50 yards is what I was saying. It's a lot farther than 50 feet. But, yeah, I mean, a bird that's going to nest on your windowsill is tolerant, obviously, of people. So what I was talking about are going to be birds that are intolerant. So if a robin comes up and nests on your windowsill and you have a lens and you're on the inside of that window or the outside, it's probably going to do okay. But the general rule is to just keep your distance, because we don't know what's going to happen with flushing the adult off the nest. And I mentioned that if it's too hot and sunny, that those eggs could cook. If she's dealing with fire ants and she can handle you know, a few fire ants climbing up on the windowsill. She can rid them of getting the eggs. Well, what if she's not there for 5-10 minutes? They could build up and really conquer the eggs. So there's a lot of unknowns. So you obviously didn't do anything wrong, but I think, you know, what I'm really focused on are these birds that certainly don't do well when humans are around. They flush. And a robin on a windowsill is probably an okay deal, and most of our backyard birds that are already used to us. So, yeah, you probably didn't ruffle too many feathers, George. So, what did your pictures look like?
They're terrific. I was going to mail you some. I don't do the internet.
Please do.
They're great pictures. It didn't seem to bother them too much.
Yeah.
And I got a remote. Shutter release now that I could stay, you know, but I'm probably going to need a longer lens if I'm going to keep shooting birds.
Right.
A lot of the places I shoot, the Red River Refuge down there, it's pretty well set up for us photographers. They got the hummingbird feeders out there. I got some terrific pictures of those hummingbirds.
Yeah.
And they got it pretty well set up. But those robins, you know, they're not... real passive birds. There was a squirrel that got a little too close.
Yeah.
And they were about to take him out.
Yeah.
They chased him two doors down.
And that's another predator that likes eggs. If, you know, you flush the parents away, the squirrel could move in and grab an egg in a split second. So, anyway, well, thanks for the call, George.
All right. And we've got to get to our conservation tip to close out this week's show. What do you got for us this week?
If you've listened to the show before, you know that I strongly encourage the creation of backyard habitat using native plants used by birds. But what if you have a really big backyard, like a couple hundred or even a couple thousand acres of great wildlife habitat that you want protected forever for birds and other wildlife? If this is your situation, you might have heard of a tool called a conservation easement. A conservation easement is a voluntary written agreement between a landowner and the holder of the conservation easement, whereby a landowner voluntarily restricts certain uses of the property, like the right to subdivide and develop the property. The landowner may continue his or her current use of the property, like the right to build a house and continue living on the property, hunt or fish, raise livestock, or other activities, provided the resources that the conservation easement is intended to protect are sustained. In our listening area, conservation easements are generally donated to nonprofit conservation organizations, commonly known as land trusts. The donation of a conservation easement can have significant tax benefits to the landowner. There are also state and federal programs that will pay landowners for the value of their easement. For landowners with wildlife habitat and a conservation desire, consider a conservation easement to rest easy knowing that your property will remain intact forever while you can receive a tax break or payment at the same time. Even if you don't live in Texas, the Texas Land Trust Council at texaslandtrustcouncil.org is an excellent resource to learn more about this tool. Do it for the birds.
All right, Cliff, once again, I want to thank you for joining us and being our resident expert ornithologist, and to thank the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for lending you to us.
Well, and thanks for all you do over there on that hot seat over there, Bill.
There you go. You have been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio. I'm the state ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, and we'd like to thank everybody at the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for loaning us Cliff for these shows and for their help for this show. This program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. As our producers are Cliff Shackelford and Bill Beckett. We had help tonight with Tim Schnell and Dee Dooley. The sound files for tonight's program can be found at xenocanto.org and were recorded by Mike Nelson. This month's bird photo on our photo page was snapped by James Childress. The audio for tonight's program will be up on the Red River Radio site in just about an hour. And please join us for the next show on Tuesday, November 12th, when we have a special on-air guest. Don't know who it is, so you'll have to tune in and find out for that. This has been Bird Calls from Red River Radio, and we are your community-supported public broadcasting service from LSUS. We are KDAQ, Shreveport-Bossier City, KLSA, Alexandria, Pineville, KBSA, El Dorado, Camden, Magnolia, KLDN, Lufkin, Nacogdoches, and KTYK, Overton, Tyler, Kilgore. Stay tuned. We have Radio Lab coming up next